you must oppose a motion by competent evidence to demonstrate that there are genuine issues of material fact. Neither side may rest on the pleadings. Be aware that self-serving affidavits are generally disregarded and may be subject to being stricken. Another purpose for summary judgment is as settlement leverage. You may want to use it to educate your opponent or your opponent's client. And typically, at the summary judgment stage, the court may inquire if there have been any settlement discussions. So consider whether a motion for summary judgment will help you transmit your message effectively to your opponent in a way to posture the case for resolution. Some cases are subject either mandatorily or by agreement to alternative dispute resolution, or ADR. ADR is generally either arbitration or mediation. Arbitration is a contractual resolution procedure whereby parties have agreed in advance to a non-judicial mechanism for resolving civil disputes. Arbitration clauses or provisions are commonly found in commercial agreements, insurance agreements, brokerage agreements, and employment agreements or employment handbooks. If you believe that you have a right to arbitration, you must assert that right at the outset or risk waiving it. The Federal Arbitration Act is found in Title IX of the United States Code, Section 1 and following, and outlines a procedure for doing this. Typically, if you have an arbitration agreement and your opponent refuses to arbitrate, you might initiate litigation demanding in your complaint that the court compel arbitration. If the court agrees, the court will usually stay the action, not dismiss it, but stay it, retaining jurisdiction, and send it to arbitration. On the other hand, if your opponent initiates the litigation and ignores an arbitration agreement, you may assert the arbitration agreement in your answer or by motion and ask the court to compel arbitration and stay the action until arbitration is completed. Typically, arbitration will be before one or more individuals, ideally with experience in the area that you are, your subject matter of your lawsuit concerns. It may be subject to formal rules like those of the American Arbitration Association or the Financial Institutions Regulatory Group, FINRA, or it may be informal. It varies from contract to contract. Understand, especially in the employment context, that if you believe that arbitration would be one-sided, would deny your client his or her day in court, you should challenge arbitration on that ground, because there is no guarantee that the court will order arbitration, and in many instances, arbitration clauses have been stricken because they are either one-sided or onerous or imposed unfairly. So evaluate that at the outset. Now, mediation, of course, is a non-binding dispute resolution mechanism. It's sometimes provided in agreements, but even if not, it is a very useful technique for trying to resolve cases without the expense of a trial and an appeal. And that is considerable expense in the federal civil system. Mediation can be before a court official that the judge appoints, or an attorney or panel of attorneys on which the parties agree or the court selects. non-binding. Theoretically, it will not affect the outcome of the case if you do not settle the case, although it is unusual that a trial judge would not be aware of what occurs in mediation. It is a great trial run if you think you're headed for trial. It's a great way to have a neutral, experienced person, be it a judicial officer or an attorney or a mediation service, evaluate both sides of the case and give you a candid reaction. The expense to mediation is minimal compared to the gains that it may provide, and I would strongly urge you to consider it, whether you're plaintiff or defendant. Now, let's assume you have done that and the court has given you time to do that and it's not resolved your case. The next thing that you need to be concerned with, of course, is preparation for trial. Typically, you will have a schedule from the court that determines when your case will be tried, not necessarily with certainty, but at least in a quarter of a year. Some courts have what they call on-deck cases, and they stack them up. If one settles, well, the next one has to be ready. So you may find yourself having to get ready for trial and then not going to trial. Your preparation is not wasted, although your witnesses and your client will be frustrated because of the scheduling inconveniences and the emotional issues and whatnot. But remember, the court has to juggle all of its docket, and by statute, the criminal docket takes precedence. What you will find is that the criminal grapevine is very effective, and if a judge is jammed up, defendants may elect to go to trial in order to make it more inconvenient for the prosecution, whereas if the trial can go ahead and the court has plenty of time, those same defendants may elect to plead. So you may get a call from the court saying, we're going to start on Monday, be here, be prepared. Now, that doesn't mean that you will start on Monday and go 8 hours every day until the case is concluded. It could mean that you would start at, for example, 10 o'clock in the morning after motions have been heard in other cases and the criminal docket addressed, and maybe go until 4 or 4:30, and not necessarily every day of the week. So think in terms, and urge your opponent to think in terms of trial days. How many trial days will be required? That will spread out over a period of weeks or a week, and that dynamic is important because it has to do with the wear and tear on you, on your opponent, on the parties, and on the witnesses. Judges will have a pretrial order that spells out how and what you're supposed to file. Make sure that your evidence is compiled, your trial exhibits are listed, you have multiple sets of them, one for the court, one for the witness, one for your opponent, one for yourself. If you're going to use electronic presentation, be aware of what the court's facilities are and how the court expects you to do that. And stipulations. Most judges encourage stipulations at trial. So be aware of the judge's requirements and attempt in good faith to reach factual stipulations. Stipulations should not be argumentative. They should be. They must be undisputed facts. So you've prepared your trial exhibits. You have your trial books ready.
Buckeye CLE's second verification code is CHILI. C-H-I-L-I. CHILI. Buckeye CLE's second verification code is CHILI. C-H-I-L-I. CHILI.
Or you have your PowerPoint prepared. You've identified your witnesses. Prepare your pretrial brief if the court will permit one. It is an opportunity, especially if you did not file summary judgment, to make the court and your opponent aware of what you intend to prove. Prepare your witnesses. Give some thought to how long they will be on the stand and what the cross-examination will involve. Prepare them for that. The general rule of thumb is you should tell a witness to tell the truth, and this includes your client. Now, you can review with the witness what they believe the truth to be, but witnesses are not intended to be ventriloquist dummies. And if you simply tell a witness how to testify, a skillful attorney on the other side will develop that fact. That will discredit both the witness and you. So make sure you understand what the witness believes his or her story to be. Resolve any factual ambiguities, but allow the witness to tell what he or she believes to be the truth. Finally, you'll need to consider motions in limine. Now, what is a motion in limine? It's not provided in the civil rules. It is an historic device that referred originally to motions presented in the roving room, that is, at the last moment, and they usually have to do with procedural or evidentiary issues. Motions in limine should not be used to delay a trial or unnecessarily complicate a trial. They should be used to clarify issues in a trial. For example, if you believe that there is an issue as to privilege which should preclude a witness from testifying, you may want to make the court aware of that in advance by a motion in limine so that the court may voir dire that witness outside the hearing of the jury or outside the flow of the trial in order not to interrupt the trial with the issues relative to that claim of privilege. The issues that can arise by way of a motion in limine are virtually endless, but they should be procedural and they should be succinct and directed to a specific issue in the case, and they should not be amenable to resolution by one of the motions for which provision is made in the rules, such as a motion for summary judgment. Now you're in trial. You have decided whether your case is to be heard by a judge or a jury or both. Your choice of exhibits and the presentation of witnesses will depend on who is hearing the case. Juries typically do not want to have to wade through volumes and volumes of technical documents. For that matter, neither do judges. You may have to mark documents so that if and when they can be placed in the record. But you should outline in your mind and on paper what you need to prove. What are the elements of the case? What are the elements of your defense or defenses? And how you're going to prove that. And you will find that the lawyer who simplifies his or her presentation to the degree possible and makes it easy to understand and presents it in a way that lay people can easily grasp will be the more persuasive advocate. And that's true with judges or juries. Now, don't forget that in a jury case, the judge will still control the trial. And if the judge doesn't like your case, he or she has ways of communicating those feelings to the jury. So you want to make every effort not to lose your judge. It may be that at the close of your opponent's case, if you're the defendant, you believe that there's no need to proceed with a defense and there may be a motion. So be prepared to evaluate the case at the close of the plaintiff's presentation of evidence and to make the appropriate motion. Be aware that some judges will hold motions for summary judgment in abeyance until they've heard the plaintiff's case and then rule on them. And other judges will hold a motion for judgment at the close of plaintiff's evidence in abeyance until they've heard your evidence. It depends on what the facts of the case are, and it depends on whether the judge wants to look witnesses in the eye and hear their live testimony. Now, you will encounter motion practice during the trial. It's not unusual for motions in limine or to dismiss certain parts of a case to be filed as the trial goes along. Be aware of that. All you can do is spend your evening hours responding to them. There'll be motions to add or delete witnesses. Certainly, fewer witnesses are almost always better. Sometimes you have to add witnesses. And if you have to add a witness or your opponent has to add a witness, be reasonable about the request. You're not going to win or lose a case based upon gamesmanship. Not certainly if you have an experienced judge. And judges do not appreciate gamesmanship. So be fair about whether or not witnesses have to be added or deleted. If you really believe you're going to be prejudiced by the addition of a witness that should have been disclosed before, then you can oppose that. That's why you have initial pretrial disclosures. That's why you have discovery that requires people to identify persons with knowledge. And the court will determine whether or not this witness should or could have been disclosed in advance. Anticipate objections to evidence. You should have a pretty good idea by the time you get to trial of what the evidence will be. And you may want to object to some evidence in advance by motion in limine. Otherwise, be prepared to assert your evidentiary objections and, if necessary, to submit legal authority to support your position during the course of trial. And finally, if you have a jury, the court will want a conference with counsel to prepare proposed jury instructions. Frequently that is done in advance of trial. Sometimes it is done towards the end of trial. But you should be giving thought during your trial preparation to what jury instructions you want given on the essential elements of your case so that a jury returns an informed verdict. Now, you may ask for jury interrogatories, that is, for the jury to answer specific questions which will inform its general verdict, and you should be prepared to submit those when the court wants them, which would generally be when instructions are submitted. Okay, your trial is over, and now you're proceeding to judgment and post-judgment issues. Civil Rule 48 provides for the verdict and jury polling, and you should be aware of that to make sure that your verdict is indeed unanimous and returned by a jury of at least 6 members. The court may poll the jury to determine that the verdict is the verdict of each member, and if it is not, refuse to honor the verdict. Civil Rule 49 provides for the general verdict and special interrogatories or special questions to a jury. I addressed that issue a moment ago. Be aware that if you don't ask the court to submit questions to the jury, you have waived that right as regards future parts of the case. So, if you want the question submitted, make sure that you timely request the court to do so. The court will either grant that or deny that, and then you make sure that that's of record in case you believe that to be error. Sometimes you will get answers to interrogatories from a jury that are inconsistent with a general verdict. And one or two more things can happen. If they are inconsistent, the judge can enter judgment consistent with the answers to the questions, even if it's not consistent with the general verdict, or send the jury back to try to figure it out, or order a new trial. So if you believe there is a risk of jury confusion, or the issues are sufficiently complicated that you want to make sure that the jury understands them, make sure you request jury interrogatories. Civil Rule 50 provides for judgment as a matter of law in a jury trial and a motion for a new trial. We've discussed judgment as a matter of law, and be aware of when you may assert a motion for a new trial. If the court doesn't agree that either that the plaintiff has not made his case or that the jury verdict is wrong, then you want to think about asking for a new trial. And you have 28 days within which to do this under Civil Rule 59. May either allow judgment on the verdict if the jury returned a verdict, order a new trial, or direct the entry of judgment as a matter of law. If the court denies the motion, you may also, as an appellee, if an appeal is taken, assert grounds entitling you to a new trial should an appellate court conclude that the trial court erred in denying your motion. If the appellate court reverses the judgment, it may order a new trial, direct the trial court to determine whether a new trial should be granted, or direct the entry of judgment. Now, in the case of trial to a court, the court will make findings of fact and conclusions of law. Typically, the court will request counsel to submit proposed findings and conclusions, and the court will pick and choose among those and maybe add its own. And this may occur after the presentation of all the evidence. The court may also make judgment on partial findings, and may utilize a special master to make factual findings. So you may find yourself sent to a special master or to a magistrate judge for certain purposes. If a party has been fully heard on an issue during a non-jury trial, and the court finds against that party on that issue, the court may enter judgment against the party on a claim or defense that under controlling law can be maintained or defeated only with a favorable finding on that issue. In other words, the issue is dispositive. The court may, however, decline to render judgment until the close of the evidence. That is frequently the case. A judgment on partial findings must be supported by findings of fact and conclusions of law as required by Rule 52. Civil Rule 53 concerns special masters. Special masters are generally appointed in complex cases, class action cases, cases in which the district judge's attention is not required at certain stages of the action. They will report to the district judge, and the district judge will adopt or decline to adopt their recommendations and findings. Frequently, magistrate judges are used in the role of special masters. The court will enter judgment under Civil Rule 54. Civil Rule 54 provides that a judgment is a written determination of the outcome of the case. It is not an opinion. Frequently, opinions are issued, but a judgment is a decree or any order from which an appeal lies. And it's important to know what the judgment is because it will start your appeal time running. You may have judgment on multiple claims or multiple parties, and a judgment may address issues such as costs and attorney's fees. Now, costs are taxed by the clerk of courts, subject to court approval. But be aware that you may have to present your evidence of costs to the clerk. Understand when a default may be entered. A default is entered by the clerk upon evidence that your opponent has failed to respond timely as required by the rules. A default judgment is entered by the court based upon the default entered by the clerk, and it is the default judgment that determines any award to be made in the case and operates just as any other judgment. Under Rule 58, the court will enter judgment by a separate document. This is the document that is going to determine when your appeal begins to run. It should be called judgment, and it should set out the outcome of the case and any award, and it is from that document that you will appeal. Civil Rule 59 governs new trials and altering or amending judgment. We've mentioned new trials. Civil Rule 60 governs altering or amending judgments. You want to be aware of that because certain errors in a judgment may be corrected within a year. Others are not subject to a time limitation. The rule provides the court may correct a clerical mistake or a mistake arising from oversight or omission whenever one is found in a judgment order or other part of the record. The court may do so on motion or on its own with or without notice. But after an appeal has been docketed in the appellate court, and while it is pending, such a mistake may be corrected only with the appellate court's leave. In that event, you may need to move the appellate court to remand the action to the trial court for the correction of the record. Grounds for relief under Rule 60 include mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect, newly discovered evidence that with reasonable diligence could not have been discovered in time to move for a new trial, fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct by your opponent, grounds to assert that the judgment is void, and evidence that the judgment has been satisfied, released, or discharged. And then there's a catch-all, any other reason that justifies relief. A motion under this rule must be made within the rule says, a reasonable time, but in the case of mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or neglect, newly discovered evidence, and fraud, no more than a year after the entry of judgment or the order or the date of the proceeding. And the motion does not affect the finality of the judgment. Understand that there are also other means of relief under Civil Rule 60D. I won't go into them now. Let's assume that you or your opponent has decided to appeal. You want to now look at a new set of rules called the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure. The notice of appeal is governed by Title 28 of the United States Code, Section 2107, and Appellate Rules 3 and 4. It must be timely filed, and be aware that a premature notice of appeal is a nullity. So if you or your opponent files a notice of appeal before there is a final appealable order, and does not file another one within 30 days after the final appealable order, you may find your appeal dismissed without recourse. So make sure that your appeal is both ripe and timely. And then you want to review the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, which will govern how your appeal is prosecuted and defended. That will conclude this presentation. Be happy to take electronically. My email is shuck@taftlaw.com. Thank you for your attention.